The Bob Murphy Show, episode 56.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. On this one, I am a man of the people. I've had several of you asking me to do an episode talking about the yield curve inversion. What the heck does that mean? So that's what I'm doing. I'm here for you. So I think also because I might get some newcomers to this episode who are listening just because, hey, for once, Bob's talking about something that's actually relevant to my life. Let me, before I jump right into the yield curve stuff, let me give the big picture about where I'm coming from, what the Austrian school is, that sort of thing. So I subscribe to a school of thought called the Austrian School of Economics. Just like there's a Chicago school, a Keynesian school, a public choice school. Well, there's also this thing called the Austrian school. We don't study the GDP of Vienna. What we do is work in the tradition of some folks who were, you guessed it, from the country of Austria. So the name comes from Karl Menger, was the founder of the Austrian school. He wrote a book which we translate as Principles of Economics in 1871. And at the time, the Germans were the dominant intellectual force in economics and plenty of other intellectual areas. And so they derided Menger's work and, you know, his disciples who followed his footsteps, they derided that as, oh, that's Austrian economics, right? Because Germany was the cultural center of the universe in their mind. And so anything that's coming, that's hailing from nearby Austria, that's got to be, you know, a bunch of peasants. Kind of that was the idea. So originally the term was one of derision, and then the name just stuck. And so now, hey, that's the Austrian school. So in the 20th century, this economist, Ludwig von Mises, fled Austria, went to Switzerland, eventually ended up at NYU. And he's one of the most important figures of Austrian economics in terms of its renaissance. And his student might be missing. This guy Hayek was already, you know, a professional economist in his own right when he started studying the work of Mises and going to his seminar. But Friedrich Hayek is his most famous, let's call him disciple or follower, who won the Nobel Prize in 1974 for his work in part elaborating upon the business cycle theory that Ludwig von Mises had developed. All right, so that's the tradition in which I place myself. And in particular, what I think is one of the most important contributions of the Austrian school is their theory of what causes the business cycle or the boom-bust cycle. So here, you know, why is it that in market economies, they seem to work pretty well, right? Like most people admit capitalism works better than socialism, at least as an economic system, whatever you think about its morality. And yet modern capitalist economies, they seem to be plagued by these recurring crises or depressions with a small d, or nowadays we call them recessions. And so why is that? Why do market economies seem to be characterized by these cyclical patterns of wild upswings where there's excessive confidence and optimism? It seems like businesses across the board are hiring, everything's expanding, it's great, times are good. And then all of a sudden, stuff turns on a dime, financial markets crash, lots of businesses start laying off workers, unemployment shoots up, and then it gets stuck like that for years on end. Why does that happen? So just to be clear, the question or the mystery is not why does any particular business fail? Because entrepreneurs are fallible. That's part of the genius of the market economy, is that no single person or group of experts is in charge. And so that's its strength, actually, that we can draw on the experimentation and the insight of just about everybody in society. So it's not that it's a rigid hierarchy and any new ideas have to come down the chain of command and be approved by some central committee. That would be very stifling. And that's one of the problems among many of what's called central planning, where a group of bureaucrats tries to rationally allocate resources and plan an economy. So it's not surprising then, given that sort of open-ended free-for-all where, hey, anybody who has a great idea and can get at least one person to back the idea financially can go ahead and start a business. That's this great and open society we have in a free economy. So it's not surprising if you have that sort of openness that a lot of times people make mistakes and they say, oh yeah, I think having a store that sells nothing but baseball cards is going to do well in this area, this town. And it turns out, no, there's really not that many fans of baseball cards in that area and you go out of business. All right. So that's not surprising. What's surprising is it seems like these entrepreneurial errors are correlated. It seems like every few years, or, you know, maybe it's longer than a few, but periodically, it seems like there's a cluster of errors. Why is it that a lot of entrepreneurs all within the same 6 to 12 months are slapping their heads and saying, oh man, what were we thinking? We expanded too much. We shouldn't have hired those last 10 workers. We got to lay them off. All right. So why does there seem to be this correlation? Why does the whole economy seem to move in macro terms on in this cyclical pattern? Because if it were just independent mistakes where you say, oh yeah, every 35 business openings, you'd expect three of them to be out of business within 2 years. And you'd expect such and such to be out of business within so many other, right? If that, whatever those numbers are that you plug in, assuming that the distribution of mistakes is an independent random variable, if you want to use that kind of language, then there's no reason to suppose that there's these wild swings in the aggregate where it seems like, geez, most businesses are doing well for a few years. And then there's this turn and lots of businesses are in trouble all simultaneously. So that's the issue. That's what we're trying to explain. So the Austrian theory, you'll sometimes see it called ABCT for Austrian business cycle theory. So this was originally developed by Ludwig von Mises in 1912. He had a book that's translated as The Theory of Money and Credit. So that's where he lays out this theory. And then, like I say, it was elaborated upon by Friedrich Hayek. So the Austrian theory of the boom bust says that, I'm obviously going to boil this down pretty simplistically here for our purposes, but it says, first of all, interest rates are prices. They have a job to do. They serve a social function, right? Just like other prices, they mean something. And so other schools of thought recognize this too. And I think, though, that the Austrians historically stressed this before other schools really picked it up and saw the significance of it. But the Austrians give special attention to this when it comes to interest rates. So just to make sure you're seeing the point, the price of oil, for example, that means something, right? If the price of a barrel of crude oil is $85, that means something. And it would be silly to say, oh, the government should just mandate that the price of oil is $30 a barrel. And that way it'll be cheaper to drive and we'll be doing favors for consumers. That'll help the economy if we make oil $35 rather than $85 or whatever numbers I said, right? That would be foolish if the reason for the reduction in price was just a government mandate. Right. If new oil is discovered and that's why the price comes down, well, then maybe that is a boon. And I know here there's climate change concerns. And so that might be clouding the discussion, but let's put that aside. I'm just saying in general, something that people use in an economy and how most people think, oh, yeah, low gas prices is a blessing and high gas prices is annoying. Even so, the market price means something. And so, like I say, if the price of a barrel of oil is $85 because that's what supply and demand dictates, then to just arbitrarily come in and push it down to $35, that's not doing anybody any favors. That's going to lead to massive shortages where people try to use more oil than there is oil to go around, right? So that wouldn't be helping anybody. So that's the real trivial case to show prices have a job to do in the market economy. And if the authorities somehow change the price without changing the underlying fundamentals, but just tried to force it, that would cause problems. You wouldn't be getting any of the benefits that you think you'd be getting from a quote low price come about from actually the fundamentals being different. So like I say, if more oil were discovered or people figured out a way to make cars more efficient so that you could go 300 miles on a gallon of gasoline, well, then that sort of thing is what would actually be beneficial to motorists. Not the mere fact that the government somehow used force to just make a barrel. You know, if they just said, hey, we catch anybody selling oil for more than $35 a barrel will put you in jail. That's not actually creating more oil. That's not making more gasoline available to consumers. And so that's why you're not getting the benefits from that ostensibly lower oil price if it's coming about at gunpoint rather than from more fundamental changes in, you know, the economic data. Okay, so that's a simple example there. So now when it comes to interest rates, Mises tells a similar story. He's saying that the conventional wisdom, and this was true way back then in the early 1900s, and it's true to this day, that most people and even most economists, it must be said, think that low interest rates in some sense help the economy. They stimulate spending. Consumers borrow and spend more at low interest rates, or also they save less, other things equal when interest rates are lower, so they spend more. And businesses borrow and invest more at low interest rates. If you're familiar with how basic accounting works, you might understand this, that you can look at a given investment project and, you know, you can know, okay, over a 20-year horizon, these are the inputs, you know, the sorts of things that we have to buy, labor, raw materials and so forth that go into this thing over time. And then this is the flow of revenue that we expect from it over time. And then you want to say in the beginning, looking at this 20-year horizon of money you got to spend on inputs and then revenue you get from selling the output, you want to ask, is that stream of cash flows something worthwhile pursuing? And the answer, again, if you've taken basic accounting, is to say, well, you need to know what's the interest rate, what's the discount rate I'm going to apply right now to those future cash flows. And the lower the discount rate or the interest rate that you use, it means the more important future cash flows are to you. So revenue that you're going to get down the road, if you're plugging in a lower interest rate when you're calculating, that revenue is going to be worth more in today's dollars because you're discounting it less. That's what's going on there. Okay, so the same investment project, like you're thinking about building an apartment complex, so you got to spend a bunch of money up front. You know, next first 2 years, let's say you're going to spend $1 million building this mid-rise apartment complex. And then once it's finished, you're going to start renting it out to tenants and get a flow of income year after year. And so that you, what you're asking when you say, should I pursue it and go ahead with this project? You're basically saying, is it worth me spending $1 million over the first 2 years to then get a flow of net income as far as the eye can see? Because I'm assuming I can always get the thing full of tenants with, you know, some modest turnover. And that, you know, once the thing's up and running, I'm going to get more in rental income than I'm going to have to pay in maintenance expenses. All right. So once the thing's built and running, it's going to be throwing off net income year after year. And I can, you know, make estimates about what that's going to be over the next 20 years. And the issue is that flow of annual rents after accounting for maintenance costs, is that worth it? Is it worth me spending $1 million in year one and year two in order then from year three going forward to get that flow of annual net income? And so that's a pretty straightforward accounting question. It's not an engineering problem. You know, an engineer can't answer that. What you need to know is, what's the interest rate that I'm going to use in these calculations? Because if the interest rate's really high, then taking my $1 million in year one and year two, I would be better just putting it in bonds. But if the interest rate that I can get in the bond market's really low, well, then maybe it is worthwhile to sink the money not into bonds, but into this physical construction project to transform my $1 million in year one and year two into a flow of dollars over time that's higher than I would get in the bond market. All right, so that's the idea. So you can see how a given investment project, as you lower interest rates, can go from being unprofitable to being profitable. And so that's where, you know, why mainstream economists, they're correct when they say lower interest rates, other things equal, promotes business investment, either because the entrepreneurs literally go out and borrow the money, or even if they're sitting on cash, that a given spending investment project looks more attractive, other things equal, the lower the interest rate is. Okay, so the mainstream approach, though, tends to say, oh, that's good, that you want businesses to be spending because that boosts aggregate demand. That what happens in a recession, they would say, is there's inadequate total spending or aggregate demand. People aren't spending enough stuff on the products that businesses produce in order for the businesses to justify hiring all the workers in society. There's not enough aggregate demand to provide full employment, right? So that's what's called Keynesian economics. That's the Keynesian mindset, named after John Maynard Keynes, whose famous book came out in 1936 in the midst of the Great Depression. All right, so that sort of Keynesian thinking permeates much of modern economics, even among people who don't explicitly call themselves Keynesian. That idea of aggregate demand being the important issue, that's something that most mainstream economists now think is really important when it comes to at least explaining what happens when there's a recession. Okay, so from that point of view then, they think, oh yeah, the government pushes down interest rates, that's good for the economy. And in the mainstream approach, the only downside really from pushing down interest rates, which gooses spending, which boosts aggregate demand, the only reason you might be against that at some point is, oh, if the economy starts overheating, as they say. So they're viewing the economy like as this giant machine where you're pressing the gas pedal. And, oh, it's, you know, definitely pressing the gas pedal gives more juice to the whole system, and that makes it go faster. But, oh, if you overdo it, it starts overheating. And we see that manifested in the form of rapidly rising consumer prices. So, like, that's the problem. That's one of the things that happened in the 70s. You know, they were pumping in too much money and prices were rising, right? So that's the mainstream view. In the Austrian view, they're saying, no, interest rates, they serve a price and they help coordinate long-term investments with what consumers really want. And so it really means something. If the interest rate is supposed to be 6% and certain long-term projects like an apartment building are unprofitable at 6%, and then the central bank comes in, buys a bunch of assets by, in a sense, electronically creating money out of thin air and pushing down interest rates to 2%, well, yeah, now all of a sudden a bunch of investment projects are going to appear profitable and entrepreneurs will go ahead and start investing in them. And that gives the appearance of prosperity. You know, the entrepreneurs, when they start building that apartment building, for example, they have to hire workers, or they hire construction crews and they go out and get subcontractors where, but ultimately that's providing demand for labor. And so that might lower the unemployment rate and raise wages in several sectors. But the problem is it's unsustainable, right? Again, the interest rate, the fact that it was 6%, that corresponding to something real, there was something real about the resources we had at our disposal and consumers' preferences about the timing of when goods should be available and come onto the market. And the fact that at 6%, assuming that was the correct market rate of interest, or what's sometimes called the natural rate, if the natural rate of interest really was 6% and certain projects were unprofitable, that's because, yeah, you shouldn't pursue them. There's a reason they're unprofitable. It's because, loosely speaking, the consumers don't want the entrepreneurs to tie up resources in such long projects. They're too impatient for that to be the right thing to do. All right. And there's no moral judgments here. It's just like if consumers didn't like cigarettes, then the price of cigarettes would crash, the price of tobacco would fall, and farmers would stop planting so much tobacco. And that would be, quote, the right thing for them to do. Because if people don't like cigarettes, then it's silly to be continuing to plant tobacco. So likewise, if consumers don't want to sit around and wait for 10 years for some product to become available, it's a mistake if entrepreneurs start this 10-year project, hiring workers and other resources and plowing them into this line that takes 10 years to come to fruition. It might look good for the workers involved up front, but the issue is it's a mistake from an economy-wide point of view, if you will. Okay, and so the big picture of what Mises says happens in the boom-bust cycle is that on the front end, the central bank and the commercial banks acting in unison flood the market with cheap credit that is not backed by genuine saving. And so that pushes interest rates down, but it's artificially low interest rates. And so that word artificially means it's not backed up by genuine saving, right? So Mises is not an opponent of low interest rates. If society all of a sudden saves a lot more out of their income every paycheck, then yeah, that will push down interest rates, other things equal. Businesses will invest in longer projects, but that's because people are more patient. They're saving more. So what does it mean when you save more? It means I'm willing to defer gratification. You have $100 right now. You could consume it right now, or you could put it away, you know, in the bank, or you'd put it in the stock market, or you put it in some other, buy a certificate of deposit. Some of you know I'm into life insurance, and there's ways you can save money in certain life insurance policies, you know, different vehicles you could use. But what are you doing economically is you're deferring consumption. And if you earn interest on it, it's you're, in a sense, giving up consumption today in exchange for a greater amount of consumption down the road. Okay, so if society is willing to do that, if consumers and households, if they genuinely save more, and that's what pushes down interest rates, well, then, yeah, you want entrepreneurs getting the green light and investing in longer-term projects. And that's what I meant before when I said in the Misesian view, so that's the adjective for Mises, Misesian, interest rates serve this coordinating role. They help coordinate long-term activities between the entrepreneurs and the households, let's say. Okay, so it's not that Mises is against low interest rates. What he's against is if interest rates drop, not because there's been genuine saving, but because the central bank, for example, just creates a bunch of money electronically and buys bonds with it. And that's what pushes down interest rates. So there, the interest rate goes down. It gives the same green light to all the entrepreneurs, right? If they're running their calculations about, is this project profitable? Well, now interest rates drop. They can go and borrow funds now, right? Because the central bank has, quote, injected liquidity into the financial markets. So if you want to go borrow money to start that apartment project, now you can. But the issue is, if you understood there was a sense in which it was wrong to start that apartment project, society was not willing to wait for that project to be built. Those resources actually should have been diverted elsewhere, that you're tying them up in a project for which the households do not have enough patience to justify it. Well, now by you pushing down interest rates artificially as the central banker, you're getting entrepreneurs to go ahead and start that project, but that's not doing anybody any favors. It appears that you have. There's this apparent prosperity, but it's built on quicksand because there's actually not more genuine savings. So society does not have enough intermediate goods, what are sometimes called capital goods, to be able to tide the households over while we wait for these new projects to finally bear their fruit, as it were. Okay. And so because there's this physical constraint that this longer production process structure is unsustainable, there has to be a crisis. Once you start the unsustainable boom, the very fact that you're calling it unsustainable means it's going to come to an end and it's not going to be pretty. And another feature of the Austrian story is that the longer the central bank keeps the artificial boom going by pumping in more and more artificial credit, or more and more unbacked credit, I should say, keeping interest rates artificially low for a longer period, the worse the eventual crisis is going to be, because that means the longer these mistakes have festered. All right. And so that's the basic Austrian story. Now, to give you, I told you a nice story. And the question is, does that have any empirical validity? Or is that just a nice tale that I've spun? Let me, for our purposes here in this episode, let me just mention the single best example I can point to show why maybe you should listen to what I'm saying on this with some concern, is that back in October of 2007, I had an article that ran at Mises.org titled "The Worst Recession in 25 Years?" And so I'll link to that article here on the podcast show notes page. So this is bobmurphyshow.com/56 if you want to see these links that I'll put for this episode. And in that article, I laid out the basics of Austrian business cycle theory like I just did for you guys here. And I showed, hey, look, it, people are worried about the housing bubble popping. So remember, I'm writing this in the fall of 2007. And I said, look, it, with the interest rates got pushed to artificially low levels, and I had a chart showing that, in particular, from June of 03 to June of 04, the federal funds target rate was 1%. And that was a historically very low interest rate before the Fed started raising rates in June of 04. So I said that, that really artificially loose monetary policy, artificially low interest rates, helped fuel the housing bubble. And now that the Fed has raised rates gradually, they're popping the bubble. And that's why we could be in store for a recession. And then where I came up with the worst in 25 years, I put a question mark because I wasn't totally committing to it, but I was saying, look how bad this could be, folks, is I was saying, to the extent that we use this mechanism to explain business cycles, and to the extent that we say the more artificially low the interest rate had been pushed, the worse the subsequent bust will be, I said, we have to go back to the interest rates of the 70s to see when they were this artificially low. Okay, and then in case you're baffled by that, it's when you take, I was doing real interest rates, right? So interest rates taking into account the rates of price inflation. So because prices were rising so fast in the 70s, even though nominal interest rates were at rock bottom levels, when you took into account how weak the dollar was becoming year after year, the fact that you had to pay, you know, you could take out a loan at a certain interest rate meant the dollars you were repaying it with were weaker. So when you took that into account, real interest rates in the 70s were actually pretty low. And so I was saying that was artificially low. That was this artificial boom. And then when Paul Volcker comes in famously and slams on the brakes, interest rates shoot up and there's a crash. I was saying you got to go back that far to see interest rates that were as artificially low in real terms as we just had under Alan Greenspan from 03 to 04. So that's why I was saying in October of 2007, this next coming crash, according to this framework, is going to be worse than all the ones going back at least to the, you know, the awful recessions of the early 80s. Because at that point, in case you don't know, the recessions, and there were two back-to-back recessions. You might think of it just as one big recession. But that recession in the early 80s was the worst since World War II at that point. Okay, so again, this was in the October of 2000. And by the way, my analysis, I actually had done the prior summer, but it was for a private client, so I can't point, you know, you would just be taking my word for it. Whereas this article in October of 2007, you can go see it's, you know, it's there in the Wayback Machine and whatever. You can verify that we're not fudging it after the fact. So that's October 2009. That's a full 11 months before the AIG crisis hit, because remember that was in September of 08. So to give you some frame of reference, the Fed, when it met in December of 2007, right, so 2 months after my article ran, the minutes of that Fed meeting, some people were worried there might be a recession, even though technically the recession began that month. Okay, so clearly, you know, the standard view was not the one I was pushing forward. So there's an example of how, using Austrian business cycle theory, I was very alarmed about a huge recession coming when a lot of people did not at all have that on their radar. Okay, so if you bought that general story, what I'm saying now is if you think it was reckless and caused a boom bust cycle for the Fed to have pushed what's called the federal funds rate down to 1% and held it there for a year, which is what happened from 03 to 04, well, in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008, the Fed eventually pushed interest rates down to 0% and held them there not for 1 year, but for 7 years. So specifically from December of 2008 to December of 2015, so seven full years, the official target interest rate was like 0% to 25 basis points, right? So hugging 0%. And if you look at measures of money, so not just what the official interest rate is, but like how does the Fed cause that by pumping in money? Then it's even worse. The charts showing how much money did the Fed pump in during the housing bubble years, you can't even see it if you graph the whole chart, because the later segments for how much money the Fed pumps in after the 08 crisis is so big that when you graph it, you know, the earlier stuff just gets pushed close to the x-axis. You can barely distinguish it from the axis because it's all hugging zero in terms of the scale. Okay, so that's the context for this. So I am going to later in this episode talk about the yield curve and why people think that's signaling a recession. And so I'm just saying for years especially with my co-author, Carlos Lara, we have been warning that these rounds of so-called QE or quantitative easing, where the Fed has been pumping in trillions of dollars and, you know, pushing interest rates down to 0%, we were warning this is not helping anybody. This is setting us up for a giant crash. This is the same thing that led to the housing boom and bust, except on steroids. So we're just setting ourselves up for another crash that will make the fall of 08 look like a picnic. Okay, so that we've been saying that for years, and where you can go to see all that stuff is at the website laramurphy.com. So it's not Laura Murphy. I'm not talking about my sister. It's Lara, L-A-R-A, that's Carlos Lara's last name. So laramurphy.com, that's laramurphy.com. Actually, it's a hyphen, but who's counting? So that's laramurphy.com is where you can see all the stuff that he and I have done over the years talking about these financial issues. Okay, So that's the basic framework with which I then approach today's issue of the yield curve. Let me also just mention too, I don't want you guys to think I'm Nostradamus and then have your bubble burst. I also, once the Fed started pumping in all this money, I was alarmed about price inflation. And I famously made a bet with two of my colleagues, Brian Kaplan and David R. Henderson. I thought the rate of consumer price inflation would top 10% annual increase at some point. We, you know, and from my bets with them, we had a certain time horizon in which that was going to happen. And I was clearly wrong. It didn't come anywhere close. The government's official measures of consumer price inflation didn't come close. By the way, for those of you tempted in the comments or an email to let me know that was stupid because, oh, the government's going to fudge the numbers. Okay, so number one, you're right. It was stupid because I lost. So obviously there was something wrong with my rationale because I lost the bets. But number two, yeah, I know the government fudges. But back in the late 70s, if the government had put out reports saying consumer price inflation was 2%, everybody just, you know, they would have stopped reading those reports because they said this is clearly bogus, right? So I thought consumer price inflation was going to be significant enough that even the official numbers, they weren't going to be able to hide it. They were going to have to admit, oh yeah, it broke double digits, right? So I was wrong. And that's why I'm not at this point shooting my mouth off about price inflation, okay? Because I don't feel confident that I understand it. So ex post, I can go back and explain what happened. But the point is, the way I thought it was going to play out at the time, when I go read the stuff I was writing, I was wrong. So that's why right now I'm not sitting here talking about, oh, and you know, the dollar's going to crash next Thursday and stuff. I'm not giving any kind of timetable for that stuff because I don't feel like I have an adequate understanding. However, what I was right about was the recession and how bad it was going to be. And so since that's the part of this analysis, or I'm relying on that framework for this discussion, that's why I still feel like, yep, even though I got that price inflation prediction wrong, I still feel like this other stuff is valid. All right. So I'll also put it, bobmurphyshow.com/56, an article that Reason magazine ran where they interviewed a bunch of us, guys like Peter Schiff and some other people who had been warning about price inflation after, you know, like in 2010, 2011, to say, hey, what do you guys say now? That sort of thing. Hey, folks, I'm going to be with the Mises Institute presenting in Seattle on September 14th, which is a Saturday. So I have some limited tickets at special prices for Bob Murphy Show listeners. If you're interested, you get in for $25, and that includes lunch. So that's a big discount compared to the standard list price. If you're interested, contact me at rpm@consultingbyrpm.com or just use the contact button at the website. And shoot me a note. It's first come, first serve. And like I say, the first 25 of you, we can get in for $25. Hope to see you there. Okay. So as far as the yield curve, let's pivot and talk about that now. Ever since World War II, if you pick it properly, when you say, like, what do you mean by the yield curve and what's an inversion and so on, it's true that for every recession, there has been a yield curve inversion shortly beforehand. And it also goes the other way. Every time there's been a yield curve inversion, there's been a recession. All right. Now, depending on the specifics, some might miss it or not. So it depends whether you're using the 10-year minus the 3-month or the 10-year minus the 2-year. And it also depends when you say, hey, there's an inversion, like there was an inversion for 3 hours of a trading day, or like it was inverted for 3 weeks. So you can see different statements made about the predictive power of this thing. But the point is, it's a pretty reliable guide that when the yield curve inverts, at least since World War II, within 2 years, there's been a recession. So what does that mean? Yield curve. So real quickly here, the yield curve, it's a graph showing, it plots the maturity lengths of bonds against their yield. So picture an XY axis. On the X axis, on the left side are short-term bonds, like 1 month, 3 month, 6 month, moving to the right, up, you know, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, 20 year, 30 year bonds. And then on the y-axis is the yield, the annualized percentage return you get on your money if you buy a bond of that maturity. So normally the graph is upward sloping. So the yield curve is an upward sloping curve in normal times, all these things are, what I'm talking about, are true, like in the modern era, let's say, you know, World War II, especially from World War II onward. Okay. And that makes intuitive sense that if you're going to lend the government money, you're going to want a higher yield to have your money tied up for 30 years than if you just lend your money for a month or for 3 months. Okay. So that's why the yield typically increases over time, or, you know, meaning the longer the maturity of the bond. And by the way, just to be clear, we're annualizing these returns. So I'm not merely saying if you lend your money for 30 years, they give you a higher percentage return total or cumulative than if you only lend your money for 3 months. That's obvious. But what I mean is, even if you annualize it and say, what's the annual rate of return you're getting effectively, still you get more per year normally if you buy a 30-year bond than if you just buy a 3-month bond. Okay, so that's the idea. So in normal times, the yield curve is upward sloping, looking at government bonds. So when the yield curve inverts, that's unusual. And what that means is the yield on shorter term government bonds is higher than on longer term ones. And the two most popular comparisons people make is the spread between the 3 month and the 10 year, and also between the 2 year and the 10 year. Okay. So in particular, when they say, oh, the yield curve inverted, usually what they mean is one of two things: either that the 3 month yield is higher than the 10 year, in which case, you know, that's an inversion, or they mean that the 2 year yield is higher than the 10 year yield, which is another way of saying, oh, inversion. Okay. So in our time, the 3 month yield has been, since I think May 23rd, has been consistently higher than the 10 year. So that's been inverted this whole time, you know, the whole summer. Whereas the 2 year yield has only just recently, in August, I'm talking in 2019 here, folks, in August, it shot above the 10 year. And then it actually, that first day, then it was only a brief thing. It was like an hour. And then it went back to being upward sloping. But then it's happened, I think, at least twice as I record this since then. Okay. So those are the differences. Now, academic economists tend to prefer the 3 month and 10 year. They think that has more predictive power. So in particular, when you're trying to say what's a better signal, looking at the historical data, it looks like the 3 month being higher than the 10 year, if you use that as your guide, that gives you a more precise indicator of whether a recession is coming and how far off it may be than if you use the 2 year being higher than the 10 year. All right. So that's just, if you want to know why is it that economists tend to prefer that measure, that's what they do. It seems like the financial press is more impressed by the 2 year and 10 year. And we certainly saw that in financial markets. Everybody was freaking out when the 2 year inverted against the 10 year in August. You know, the market came down, I think, like almost 3%, depending on which index you look at, the day that the 2 year shot above the 10 year, whereas they weren't as freaked out about the 3 month going above the 10 year. Okay, so that's just, you know, a little inside baseball for that. Also at BobMurphyShow.com/56, I'll put at least one link to an academic paper that the Fed put out on yield curve inversions. And so you can go look and get more, you know, for those of you who are serious geeks on this stuff, if you want to get more of the academic literature and, you know, and see some of the rigorous work behind these kind of statements I'm throwing out loosely here. Okay. So now we've got this empirical relationship where, for some reason, at least since World War II, it seems like when the yield curve inverts, that usually means that a recession's coming. And also, you would expect if a recession is going to hit us, there would have been a prior yield curve inversion, right? So there's very few false negatives or positives, possibly zero false negatives or positives if you define, you know, like I say, what you mean by an inversion correctly. So then the question is, well, why should that be? Why does that happen? And so let me read to you. So this is from Paul Krugman, August 15th, 2019. I'm jotting a note to myself here to link this in the show notes page also, in case you want to see the context. And so Krugman, talking about this, says, an old economist joke says that the stock market predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. Well, an inverted yield curve, when interest rates on short-term bonds are higher than on long-term bonds, predicted 6 of the last 6 recessions. And a plunge in long-term yields, which are now less than half what they were last fall, has inverted the yield curve once again, with the short versus long spread down to roughly where it was in early 2007 on the eve of a disastrous financial crisis in the worst recession since the 1930s. So one more paragraph here I'll read from Krugman. Neither I nor anyone else is predicting a replay of the 2008 crisis. Actually, editorial comment, I am. All right. So I'm not saying the crisis is going to happen right away, but I think that the central banks of the world just kicked the can down the road. Okay, so now coming back to Krugman. It's not even clear whether we're heading for a recession, but the bond market is telling us that the smart money has become very gloomy about the economy's prospects. Why? The Federal Reserve basically controls short-term rates, but not long-term rates. Low long-term yields mean that investors expect a weak economy, which will force the Fed into repeated rate cuts. Okay, so that's Krugman's explanation, and he's written elsewhere in a few of his recent columns on why the yield curve inverts before a recession. And that's always the basic approach his explanation takes. And here I'm just picking on Krugman because I read his stuff professionally for my other podcast. And so it's fresh in my mind. And he's a clear writer. So this isn't some theory unique to Paul Krugman. He's echoing what a lot of mainstream economists would say. So I think that that's a faulty explanation for at least two reasons. So one reason is that if you think about what he's saying, let me paraphrase it just to make sure I didn't lose people. So what Krugman is saying is, oh, the reason the yield curve has just inverted now, as I, Paul Krugman, write in August of 2019, is that investors are becoming increasingly pessimistic about the economy's long-term prospects. So they think either a recession or a very slow-growing economy is in store for us shortly down the road. And so what's true? If we know that there's going to be a bad economy a few years out, either one, an outright recession or just very sluggish growth, well, what the Fed will cut interest rates in that scenario. And so if we know that like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years from now, I'm not throwing out a range, I'm saying for all those years successively, we'll probably have pretty low short-term rates because that's what the Fed directly controls is very short-term rates. Well, then now when I'm saying how much money, you know, or how much yield should I be willing to tolerate on a 5-year bond or a 7-year bond or a 10-year bond? Well, there's a sense in which the yield right now that I would be willing to purchase on a 10-year bond is going to be related to what do I think I could get for my money if I just kept rolling it over at the short rates. And so if we change our expectations and we go to now all of a sudden becoming very pessimistic and we think that short rates, you know, from year 3 to year 7, 8, 9 from now are going to be a lot lower, well, then how much I'm willing to pay more for a 10-year bond if it's got a higher long run average yield. And so by doing that, I push up its price, I push down the yield. So ultimately the idea is the rate of return you're going to get from a 10-year bond is related to what if you rolled your investment over in a series of 1-year bonds, or what if you did 2 5-year bonds and rolled them over, that kind of thing. So they don't have to be literally the same number, but they got to be related to each other. There's an arbitrage there. Okay, so that's Krugman's story. And so he's like, oh yeah, so if all of a sudden investors expect there to be an imminent recession, you can see why long-term yields would plummet. And then that's why they might fall below short rates. And then you get an inverted yield curve, and that happens whenever a recession's coming. So there you go. Mystery explained. So I think that explanation's lacking, and there's at least two problems I have with it. So number one is, if you think about it, what Krugman's basically saying is, oh, there's this inverted yield curve that seems to give us all information about how the economy is about to enter a recession. And how does the yield curve seem to know that? Oh, it's because bond investors know a recession's coming and they trade accordingly. And that makes bond yields, you know, have this pattern. And then we all look at that. We all know, oh, a recession's coming. So it's like investors know there's a recession coming. They trade a certain way. And then investors look at the results of their trades and say, oh no, a recession's coming. So you see how that's kind of circular argument? Or a circular argument. Okay, now let me just mention as an aside that glib little demonstration I went through to try to say, aha, you know, investors know something and then they just trade a certain way and then back out what they already know. That's goofy. There are certain things in economics where that's not a goofy explanation. So let me go on a very quick digression here, partly to interest those who have heard me talk about the yield curve before to give you something new, to reward you for hanging in this far. And also just to cover my bases, I don't want people to walk away thinking a certain thing about the way the world works. So again, in principle, it's possible that a bunch of people entering a market, that the market somehow pools their information, and people looking at the market price can get more, you know, they can learn something from the market price, even though it was just people and their knowledge that made the market price what it was. Okay, so I'm not ridiculing the very possibility of that kind of phenomenon. So for example, there's this thing called the winner's curse. And you, so let's say I'm in a classroom and I have a big jar of change, right? So I got this big jar on my desk, I'm a teacher, and it's full of pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters. And I show everybody in the class this, and I say, okay, now I'm going to have an auction. So each of you children, you're going to take out a piece of paper and you're going to write down your bid for how much money you're willing to pay me for the contents of this, jar. And it's clear, by the way, it's transparent. It's a glass jar. Everybody can look in it and see. Okay. But it's big. And so, you know, let's say there's 20 kids in my classroom and they all pull out their pieces of paper and they write down the bid. And I say, and whoever of course has the high bid, you pay me that much in cash and then I'll give you the jar and you can get to keep the change. And so they go ahead and do this. So there's this thing called the winner's curse, meaning in a lot of settings and like this, the winner ends up overbidding. And the reason, if you think about it, if you're the winning bid in that classroom setting, that means the amount of money you thought was in the jar. So let you, first of all, I got to be clear. What strategy are people using? Typically, what somebody would do in a setting like that is they would look at the jar. They would try to estimate, well, how much money do I think is in there? And then they would bid a little bit below that number, right? Because there's no point in paying exactly what it's worth because then it's just a wash. So you want to underbid a little bit to give yourself a margin of profit. And also because maybe you're wrong, right? So depending on how confident you are in your estimate, if you're really not sure at all, maybe you want to put a bigger gap between your bid and what you actually think's in there. But the point is, if most students are employing some rule of thumb like that, then the winner is almost certainly going to have overbid. And the reason is, think about it. Let's say every kid is using that rule of thumb and saying, you know what, I'm going to guess how much is in there, and then I'm going to like bid $2 less to try to give myself $2 in net profit from this. So if there's 20 kids in the classroom, probably the winner overbid, because think about it. The only way you're going to win is if the other 19 kids all thought there was less money in there than you did, or going the other way. The only way you're going to win, assuming everybody's strategy is the one I just said, is if your estimate of what's in that jar is the highest in the room, and the more kids there are, that means the more people that you were the high estimator out of all of them. And so especially what if I increase it? If I exaggerate, it might make it more obvious. Suppose I'm in a university setting where I'm lecturing, to an Econ 201 crowd, and there's 500 students in the auditorium. And I do the same trick. I have this jar of change in the front. I got to we'll let the students come up and look at it from 2 feet away if you want, so they can get a good look. And now I do the same deal. If you're the winning bid in that situation, that means 499 other students all thought there was less money in there than you did. So the point is, probably you way overestimated how much change is in that jar, because what are the chances that you're right and the other 499 people were all way too pessimistic? No, probably if there's like a bell curve of, the actual amount in the jar, then the estimates of, presumably the midpoint of the bell curve of the guesses is close to what the true number is. And then there's some people who are way too high and some people who are way too low. And so necessarily the winning bid, if everybody uses the strategy I said, is going to be the one that was way too optimistic. So you say, oh yeah, I'm thinking there's probably $18 in there. So I'll bid 16 and you get it. And there's only $12 in there, that kind of deal. Okay. So what's a cool little thing in there is you might throw up your hands and say, oh, so I guess auctions don't work. Well, no, if everybody knows that, and if it's a setting like this where there's sort of a quote objective value of the object, assuming that everybody really just wants to maximize money, it's not that they, get some special thrill out of winning, or they don't just like to auction per se and they love the process of bidding. But if everybody in the classroom, we assume, is really just trying to maximize financial gain, and we assume people have an unbiased estimate of what's in there. They could be wrong, of course. There could be error. But if we assume that the errors are not correlated with each other, that kind of thing, making some simple assumptions like that to get the argument to go through, it turns out that what you do is you estimate how much you think is in there, and then you look and see how many other people are bidding on it, and you reduce your bid based on how many total people are bidding. Okay, so other things equal, if you know you're in an auction, if it's just you and one other guy bidding on that jar, you're going to bid much closer to what you actually think the value is. But if it's you in a setting, a classroom setting with 499 other students, and you think there's $18 in there, you're not going to bid close to that. You're going to bid way lower because you're going to realize, because the only scenario in which your bid matters is if you're the winner, if you're the high bidder. And so then you have to say to yourself, whoa, in a scenario where I'm the high bidder, that means every single other person bid lower. Da, 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 you run through. Okay. So that's just an example where you can actually, in a sense, rely on everybody else's estimations as well. So it's kind of a cool little concept. And that's why I walked through it, by the way. It's not that I really care about bidding on jars of change and that's going to change your life. It's the notion there. Notice what you did. And the point is, everybody can be doing that, and that's a new equilibrium. So everybody can be perfectly rational. They can all be aware of this phenomenon of the winner's curse. And then what they do is, in equilibrium, they all adjust their bid to take into account of how many other people are bidding. And then it's the case where the more people you add, you would expect the winning bidder, to have the correct bid and all that kind of stuff. All right, so that's kind of another more real-world application of that is when oil companies are bidding on drilling rights. Right. So like the government owns a bunch of land that probably it's somewhere, has oil deposits, and the oil companies are bidding on the right to drill test wells and to see if they can develop it. Well, originally when they were doing that, the winning bidder, right? So the oil company that bid the most, that offered the most money for the rights to drill on the land, they would typically be disappointed. It would turn out that it wasn't profitable, right? That they spent too much money acquiring the rights to drill based on what they ended up producing from the wells in that region. And again, so it was the winner's curse in action. They realized, wait a minute, if we won the bid, that means all of our competitors with their geologists who are also working on the case, they all thought there was, that these deposits would be less lucrative than our team did. That's the only reason we won the bid or the auction. And so what are the chances that, we're right and they were all too pessimistic? No, chances are the reason we won is because our bid was too optimistic, right? So once oil companies learn that, they started taking that into account when they made their bids. Okay, so again, there's a way that you're sort of relying on the information of other people. Or another application of this kind of concept is, in general, let's say there's people who have some inside information about some pending lawsuit against a company. Okay, so regular investors looking at the information, they might think the stock price is supposed to be 100, and then all of a sudden the stock price gets pushed down to 90. Oh, and then the next week it turns out there's some announcement and there's a big lawsuit now that's merged against the company. So the idea is that the few investors who somehow knew about that, they were shorting the stock and it's pushing the price down. Okay, so there's lots of applications where the market price kind of incorporates all the relevant information or knowledge that different people in the economy have, and it sort of crystallizes that information in one form or another. All right. So I'm not poo-pooing the whole premise or the whole concept of investors can know something and then we can look at the market to try to back out some of that information. But what I'm saying is, at least at a superficial level, Krugman's story is that bond investors know a recession's coming, right? So it's not just saying, oh, some group of investors know that this particular company is having a bad year, and so they push down its price, and then this group of investors over here knows this company. And then if we look at the whole thing put together, the economy's bad. That's not the story Krugman's telling. The story Krugman's telling is that bond investors think the economy's going to be bad 3 years from now, and they forecast the Fed's going to cut rates then, and then that's what's causing the yield curve to be inverted now, and that's how we know, uh-oh, a recession's coming. So again, it's not that the market is amalgamating information from a bunch of different sources to produce something that's greater than the sum of its parts. It's Krugman is assuming that there's some investors who really do know a recession's coming. And for some reason, they're, you know, better forecasters than the rest of us, or, you know, they have more money at their disposal and we're learning from them. So that's fine. But then that just begs the question, okay, well, how do those investors know? What theory are they using to say that the recession's coming? Hey folks, let's take a quick break. I've been alluding to the work that I do with Carlos Lara, so let me say it officially in this commercial. If you want to subscribe to our monthly financial publication, the Lara Murphy Report, the details as well as a bunch of free sample issues are all available. Check it out at bobmurphyshow.com/LMR. That stands for Lara Murphy Report. So that's bobmurphyshow.com/LMR. At the very least, go check out the free sample. Okay, so that's one problem I have with Krugman's explanation of the predictive powers of the yield curve. The other more substantive problem I have is that his story just doesn't fit the facts. That, for example, he's making it sound like if you didn't know any better from Krugman's explanation, you would think that, oh yeah, historically, the reason the yield curve inverts a short while before a recession is that the 10-year yield's chugging along and then all of a sudden falls off a cliff because now a bunch of investors realize a recession is imminent. They get pessimistic, that pushes down 10-year yields. And so that's why it dips below the short yields, whether it's the 2-year or the 3-month. Up, and then you have an inversion and there you go. And no, just empirically, that's not what happens. So if you want to see it, go to the blog post I'll have up at laramurphy.com that I'll link to from bobmurphyshow.com/56 if you want to see the chart to buttress what I'm saying here. But if you decompose the yields, so you're not just looking at like a 10-year minus a 2-year, but instead if you're looking at the absolute value of the 10-year and the absolute value of the 2-year or of the 3-month, you can see it more clearly with the 3-month. You'll see that what typically happens before a recession, it's not that the 10-year yield falls off a cliff. It's that the 3-month yield zooms upward to overshoot it. That's what makes the yield curve invert. It's not that long yields collapse. It's that short yields rise. And you see this most beautifully in the housing bubble years, right? So the yield curve inversion that happened shortly before the financial crisis, the 10-year yield didn't fall at all. Right before the inversion happened, the 10-year yield was stable. In fact, it was higher than it had been in several years. And what happened is the short rate, because the Fed was tightening, kept ratcheting upward and eventually overshot the 10-year yield. And then that's what made the yield curve invert. And then shortly afterward, so soon enough after that inversion happened, both the short and the long-term yield started plunging going into the 08 recession. But I'm saying if you look and see what happened to cause the yield curve to invert, it was not at all that the long-term yields went down. It was that the short yields went up. And that pattern is true before all the recessions, at least the ones that we can see using the standard data available from the Federal Reserve's online charting mechanisms, like your tools, going back decades. Okay? So again, just to say that one more time, the way Krugman was explaining this historical pattern where the yield on short bonds, like a 2-year or a 3-month bond, was higher than the yield on a 10-year right before a recession hits, Krugman was explaining that by saying, oh, what happens is investors become pessimistic about the state of the economy in the near term. That pushes down the yield on 10-year bonds. And so that's why that yield dips below the short-term rates, right? Because I guess the idea is being the short bonds are going to mature before the recession hits. So that's why the yield on the short rates stays higher than the yield on the 10-year. And then that's what causes the inversion. And I'm just saying, no, empirically, that's not what happens. It's the other way around. It's the yield on the 10-year is fine, and then the short-term yields shoot up and overpass it. And that's what causes the inversion. Okay, so do I have an alternative explanation then to explain that? Well, I'm glad you asked. Yes, I do. That Austrian story that I told you in the beginning of this episode, the Mises Hayek story, explains these empirical facts quite nicely. So again, that story, the way it explained the standard boom bust cycle was to say in a normal expansionary phase, the boom period, what's going on is the central bank and the commercial banks are flooding the financial markets with cheap credit that's unbacked by genuine saving. And what does that do? I said, well, it pushes down interest rates. But let's be more specific. Which interest rates? Well, the Fed can to the extent that it can move interest rates at all, it has more effect on short-term rates. In this episode right now, I don't have time to get into that, like to try to justify that, but I'm just going to assert that when the Fed buys bonds and pushes down interest rates by creating money electronically, it has much more power to push down short-term rates. One element of what's going on is, just think of it this way. If the Fed's trying to push down long-term rates by creating hundreds of billions of dollars, well, to the extent that that makes people think price inflation is going to rise eventually, well, then they're going to want some compensation in long-term bonds because of those rising prices. And so the Fed can't as easily, it'd be hard for the Fed to create enough money to push down 30-year yields to 0.1%. In fact, it might be literally impossible, right? Because even if the Fed starts creating trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars just buying 30-year bonds, trying to push down the 30-year yield to 0.1%, well, by creating all those trillions of dollars, eventually people might say, yeah, that money is going to certainly over the next 30 years push up prices. And so why would I lend money now at 30 years and only get 0.1% back per year? Because, you know, the dollars I'm going to get paid back with 30 years from now are going to be worth nothing because the Fed's creating all this money. Whereas if the Fed's creating trillions of dollars buying short-term bonds, it might be able to push them down to 0.1%. In fact, it did for really short-term bonds. Because you're not as worried, you know, if it's just a one-month bond, you're thinking, oh, okay, well, I'll lend money for 1 month and get paid back. And, you know, those trillions of dollars the Fed's pumped in, that's not going to have made the price of bread go to $30 a loaf just in 1 month. And that's what we saw empirically. The Fed did pump in trillions of dollars since 2008, and it didn't make prices go through the roof. Okay, so that's part of the explanation for why the Fed has the ability to push down, at least within limits, short-term rates, but it doesn't have nearly the power to push down long-term rates. Okay, so back to the story then. If in a boom period, what's going on is the Fed's pumping in money, pushing down interest rates, actually it's pushing down short rates. And long rates might not be going down. They might even be going up a little bit if people build in a higher expectation of price inflation because of that money getting pumped in. So that's going to make the spread normal, right? Where the long-term yield is higher than the short-term yield. Then as the boom progresses, things start overheating in the mainstream description. The Fed chickens out and they start tightening and they raise interest rates. So again, when I say the Fed raises interest rates, what do we mean? We mean short rates. That in the tightening phase, it's short rates that shoot up, not long rates. If anything, long rates might come down a little bit as people think there's going to be slower growth and less price inflation. Oh, now the Fed's tightening. Okay, so now we're going to revise our expectations about how many dollars are floating around over the next 30 years, meaning price inflation is lower than we otherwise thought before we got news of the tightening. All right, and so that's what causes the inversion. When the Fed tightens hard after a big expansion, it can cause short rates to shoot above long rates. And so then is it any surprise in the Austrian story that when the Fed first pumps in money and then reverses course and slams the brakes, it causes a recession? No, that is the Austrian story. That's what causes the recession. And so I'm saying it's not surprising that you would see this play out in the form of a yield curve that was, quote, normal during the boom and then inverts right before the bust hits. That's actually, you know, that lines up quite nicely with the standard Austrian story. And also notice it doesn't have the feature of, oh, everybody knows a recession's coming or all the smart people know a recession's coming and they trade accordingly. And then everyone looks at that and says, oh, a recession's coming. No, that's not in the story. The reason the recession happens is because of what the central bank did. Whether or not investors know it is irrelevant in my version of what's going on or my explanation. Okay, so that's my overall view in terms of timing. I spell this out more in the Laura Murphy report. So if you really want to get the inside scoop in my views, go to bobmurphyshow.com/LMR to subscribe to the Laura Murphy report. It's only $10 an issue. It's pretty cheap. And you can see my thoughts fleshed out more. But just so as not to leave you hanging or to be coy, I think the recession this time around is probably going to start in late 2019 or up through possibly the summer of 2020. Now, let me be clear. What I mean is years from now, looking back, economists will say, ah, yes, that recession officially started, whatever, in December of 2019 or whatever the exact, or May of 2020. It doesn't mean in real time, everybody's going to know that's a recession. Just like for the last one, officially, this last recession started in December of 2007. but people didn't know the recession had started in December of 2007. Remember, like I told you, at that Fed meeting in December of 07, I think it was like Janet Yellen was saying, oh, she was worried a recession might be soon. And everyone was later saying how smart she was. Well, she didn't predict the recession. She didn't even post-dict it, right? The recession had already started when they were talking and they didn't know it. All right. So that's let only, like I said, that not only did they not predict it, they didn't even post-dict it. But the point being, so when I say that I think the recession this time around is probably going to start in late 2019 up through summer of 2020, what I mean is that's when I think they're going to book it as the official start down the road when they're looking back. Because again, it's not obvious. The economy is so complex that even the methods they use to diagnose it, a lot of that stuff, they have to, there's a lag. They got to wait for the numbers to come in and they revise them, blah, blah, blah. And then looking back, they say, ah, you know what? Looks like the economy officially started contracting back in December of 2019, even though we had no idea at the time, or not that we had no idea, even though we couldn't be sure of it at the time. Okay, well, let me wrap up there. And also, if you say, well, gee, what do I do now, Bob? Well, you can subscribe to the Lara Murphy Report. Also, if you go to LaraMurphy.com, Carlos and I have a video up there saying how to weather the coming financial storms. And so I still stand behind the recommendations we give in that video. Last thing I'll say is don't sue me. All right. So go talk to your tax attorney. Don't make any major financial moves without consulting with the proper experts on this stuff. But if you're asking me what are my views as to what's going to happen with the economy, that's what I would say. Thanks for listening, everybody, and I will see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.